Hi, Stephen. Can you hear me coming through now?
Oh, I heard something there.
Okay. Am I coming through?
Yeah, I hear your voice.
Okay. I think that was probably just the start of the recording. So
yeah, I heard a beep of some sort.
Okay, that would be it. So, okay. Well, for the sake of getting started on the interview and the podcast, I'll post this online probably shortly after we're done chatting here today.
Okay.
And basically what I'm looking at or chatting or hoping to chat with you about is sort of an overview of what's happening in the space of knowledge. You made an interesting point on a presentation. I think it was in 2004, and I don't even have it in front of me exactly where it was that you were presenting, but essentially you made this statement that as knowledge goes, so goes learning. And I think that was in regard to just some of the changing dynamics of knowledge that you were talking about. So, and to attend to that, you put together a document in late last year entitled Connective Knowledge.
Right.
And I think you set in motion a very important concept at that stage, which is that our perspective of what knowledge is from the traditional types, namely qualitative and quantitative, that perspective isn't sufficient. Would you mind just giving us a quick overview of what connective knowledge is and why we need a different epistemology, if that's the right term to use?
Okay. Let's begin with qualitative knowledge and quantitative knowledge. Qualitative knowledge is probably the oldest type of knowledge that we have, and it's the knowledge that we typically get from the senses about the qualities of objects, their color, for example, their shape, their texture. One of the major advances in logic and reasoning was to be able to abstract from that and create what's called quantitative knowledge. And quantitative knowledge is the assignment of numbers to things, the obvious instance of it being to count objects, you know, one object, two objects, three objects. But even things like measurement, for example, and Cartesian geometry, to assign numbers to points in space. Quantitative knowledge is very important, because the use of numbers allows us to come up with things like general principles and natural laws, which create or allow for measurements and projections of future events. Connective knowledge is a third type of knowledge along these lines, and basically what it consists in is the relations between the entities. I want to be a little bit careful here, because in traditional qualitative knowledge, we can talk about the relations of an object. For example, we can talk about John being 3 meters tall, but we can also talk about John being taller than Fred. But connective knowledge is and consideration of these relations in the abstract, and consideration of these relations as a totality, such that when you look at the set of relations, you are able to perceive or observe patterns in those relations. And it's this pattern perception that becomes connective knowledge. And the reason why it's distinct from the qualitative knowledge is that the perception of these patterns actually requires a perceiver. It's a perceptual process. The patterns exist only insofar as they are recognized to exist. So it's a way of seeing the world as much as it is a way the world is. That's the quick overview. Might not be the best overview I've ever done, but it's the one that occurs to me right now.
No, and that's great. I think one of the things certainly coming across it was this, from my own experience at least, when you see how we've classified knowledge and how we've talked about knowledge. And I have a bit of a personal interest. I'm currently putting together a short text that I'll be putting online in the next probably 4 weeks or so, on just the changing nature of knowledge. And one of the sort of the key distinctions that I found was just the inadequacy of some of the traditional views of knowledge in describing what's happening when we're reacting and relating to others online, and what's happening when that information flow becomes so overwhelming that it's hard to absorb it all. You use qualitative in terms of a sensory experience. It's hard to absorb it all through our senses. It's almost that, you know, you need to step back one space and do exactly what you're talking about with connected knowledge, which is trying to perceive what's the pattern that's emerging, because we can't micro consume all of the elements because of the pace that it's occurring at.
So loose and not entirely accurate way, but seeing the forest is kind of like seeing connected knowledge, or seeing relations between trees as a separate entity. Although, of course, something is a forest only as a matter of our perceiving it. It's not the best example in the world, because there is, you know, I mean, forests do have objective existence. But, you know, it's that sort of way of drawing out and separating mass events in the world. I should have been quiet. And I don't think that helped at all.
Well, I think what I see, and you could certainly, I'd like to hear your opinion on it, but you know, I've seen the change in knowledge, and I've described it two ways, and I've had some individuals that have agreed with me and some that have not. But on the one level, the two prominent changes that I see, at least, is we have the contextual changes, the changes that are occurring in our society as a whole. And by this I'm referring to, you know, just the fact that, you know, end-user publishing and anyone can create content and anyone can throw out knowledge, and the fact that we're becoming more and more social in all of our processes. The software tools that we have access to are enabling that. We have a pretty constant sense of immediacy that we didn't have in the past, where everything is sort of right now. So, you know, this combination of the rising of an individual, the fact that we can have everything immediately, that the content elements that used to be filtered by publishers have now been broken down to something that you and I and whoever is interested can do on their own. So those are sort of context changes that occur in the environment of knowledge. The second end, and this is the one that I think interests me the most, is the actual change to the core of knowledge. Now, you and I had a brief discussion on this probably, it's been almost a year ago now, but it was when we were discussing, I think it was actually on the Connectivism blog, where we were talking about learning. And I think one of the discussions that came out was just that, you know, has learning itself actually changed? You know, the actual chemical act of learning, is that any different than what it used to be, let's say, 50 or 100 years ago? So in a knowledge sense, I mean, it seems that knowledge is changing. So I'd love to hear your view on, is it changing? Is it different to know today than what it was 20 or 100 years ago?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, there are many levels at which you can ask that question. At a certain level, the answer is no. Human brains, so far as I know, work pretty much the same today as they did 20 years ago or 50 years ago. Knowledge still today consists in sets of associations and relations between neurons being created through psychophysical processes in the brain as a consequence of external stimulus. As we also know, there isn't one single canonical organization of the brain. Each brain is organized differently. Each set of neurons in a person's mind organizes differently, and indeed even that organization changes over time, and the nature of that organization is probably changing. The simplest thing is, if we know something different today than we knew 20 years ago, then our knowledge must be different, and therefore our organization must be different. Frankly, I'm hard pressed to go beyond that. I mean, I'm certainly reading right that people's brains process information differently today than they did 20 years ago. That the net generation learner's mind is actually physically different, and what that means, of course, is that the neural organization is different. Because again, I mean, you know, it's not like we suddenly swapped out neurons for, I don't know, acorns. You know, I mean, like the basic hardware is the same. So it must mean the organization of this is different. But I don't see the capacities as being different. You know, and, you know, it's funny when I read David Hume, who's writing in the 1700s, and he says that our knowledge is the product of custom and habit, and that we, you know, we fall into this habitual belief, and that to know something is a matter of a you know, an inability or an unwillingness to give up a belief, that it's a strength of our affiliation toward a belief. That, from more than 200 years ago, sounds very similar to what I see today. And so, you know, I mean, I think that the basic structures haven't changed. I think that the way we adapt to the world has changed because the world itself has changed. But, you know, I don't see evidence that, you know, the base mechanics have changed. And it's those base mechanics that are very interesting to me. And so, yeah, sure. I mean, the Annette Jenner sees the world differently. Well, of course, the Annette Jenner sees the world differently. I ran an item in my newsletter on Saturday, a person who's trained in music sees or hears music differently than a person who's not trained. And you think, well, of course, a person who's trained in computers and knowledge systems sees knowledge differently. And you sort of go, of course. And it's a question of perception. It's a question of pattern recognition. What patterns do they see when they look at the world? And I think that's what the difference is.
Okay. And I think they're I'll get back to the concept of changed knowledge in just a second, but it does remind me a bit of a recent article that I threw up in my blog and newsletter as well, and that just talked about how certain individuals who have, I guess some call it deep smarts, but that intuitive sense, and they're able to look at a particular situation, and as you mentioned, they're able to see the implications and the patterns much more clearly than someone else. And the question that always boils down to, is that innate or has that been trained? And the outcome of this article at least stated quite clearly that a person who spends enough time with a chessboard eventually will acquire, to varying degrees, the deep smarts of someone. So it's not a function of being born with it. It's a function of conditioning and training your mind to be able to recognize and see those patterns rapidly, even though some of us may intuitively have stronger dispositions in certain regard to do that well.
I think we'll probably find that there's a chemical physical basis as well to the rapidity at which we'll leap to the recognition of a pattern. You know, I think that, you know, it, like recognizing a pattern is one of these sort of on-off sort of things. It's one of these gestalt things. And the speed at which a pattern clicks in our mind is obviously a chemical physical process, and that can be altered by the chemical physical composition of the brain. So, I mean, if you're more likely to form links between neurons, then you're more likely to snap into a pattern recognition. I think there's probably, you know, fertile grounds for research there. Research that I won't be conducting because I don't do, like, gooey, messy stuff.
Well, I read a book several years ago on the concept of neural pathways, and one of the assertions that this author was fairly graphic in communicating it, but essentially stated that when we encounter a position of fear, our mind is actually scorching a neural pathway to some kind of an associationism with that particular item, so that in the future, if let's say we have a, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder as an example, but we have that particular encounter, when we encounter that again, it's almost that our mind is rewalking neural pathways that it had created before. So, I mean, that concept of being able to recognize patterns based on repetition or based on the intensity of a moment does seem to allude
right.
that we have some preformed patterns neurologically that we create.
And that's why a psychologist will say it's like reliving the moment, because we're actually having that very same perception. The very same neurons are being activated.
Which then, if you know, the research with mirror neurons, which are getting probably more hype than practical application right now, but the essential statement they had was they did a research with a monkey, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, so this is more for the listeners, but the where they had a monkey and they sort of scanned what the brain waves of a monkey were doing when it was, you know, when it saw a banana or when it reached for a banana and or even ate a banana, and then what happened when it saw an image of a monkey performing those kinds of functions. And essentially same areas of a brain were being highlighted, whether they were doing it themselves or whether they were watching it being done. So in a sense, and this is sloppy science that I'm throwing out, but it's conceivable that if we relive a memory, we're activating the same neural pathways, so that our brain may not even differentiate between memory and reality per se. But that's, again, speculative. What's change with knowledge then? Just getting into that. If our neurons function on a similar way, what's happened? What's different about knowledge today from 30 years ago? Because my literature feels a whole lot different than it did.
Sure. We're understanding today that perspective or point of view matters a lot more than we thought it did. And because perspective or point of view matters so much, the idea of there being authoritative knowledge or that the expert knowledge, it becomes much less important. We've had this debate before even about whether there's objective, you know, whether knowledge is objective, things are objectively true, or whether things are only subjectively true. And we can argue, you know, the hard case, you know, here is a chair, is that objectively true? But, you know, when we start pushing the envelope about this a bit, we begin to see that, you know, in common day-to-day usage, the knowledge as touted by the authorities certainly much called much more into question. Questions like, for example, what is the good life? Is the good life to be, you know, productive, obedient, obeying the law, obeying the authorities? There was a time not so long ago, like say the 50s, where that was the good life, and everybody knew that that was the good life, and that, you know, and a good person got married and stayed married, and of course was heterosexual and had two children, etc. And today, that view has been called into question. And the thing is, some people hold to that view. Some people have different views on what constitutes a good life. And then others are just sort of, they don't know. And there's no authority or expert who can answer that sort of question for us anymore. And on most of these foundational issues, what is the basis of society? What's the relation between freedom, autonomy, and responsibility, etc.? More and more, we're less inclined to accept expert guidance and more and more inclined to draw our own conclusions. And we're seeing this slowly seep into the factual realm. The dissolving authority of news sources, for example, newspapers, television news, as from time to time, you know, we see them being caught up reporting things that aren't true or fabricating the news. The 60 Minutes, was it, where, you know, they staged the blowing up of a car because they couldn't actually get the car to blow up properly, to the stuff before the war in Iraq. And, you know, you have the New York Times coming out in an editorial saying, gee, we jumped on the bandwagon here. We were completely irresponsible. And then, like, 2 weeks later, going and doing the same thing again and not even realizing it. And we're seeing challenges rise against these authoritative sources of information for news. We're seeing the rise of the blogosphere, and we're seeing, in contrast to, you know, the edited and filtered reports from the front lines, we're seeing photographs taken by people who are actually under the bombs as they dropped. Well, not directly under the bombs, those people are dead, but the other people, the ones who are, like, close. And, you know, you begin to ask, you know, what is authoritative in this case? You know, somebody sitting there in Beirut, Lebanon, saying a bomb fell last night, and your newspaper says all was quiet. Now you really begin to have to question for yourself, what is true and what is not. And so the onus much more is falling on the individual to make their own decisions, to approach knowledge autonomously, to evaluate and weigh different possibilities, and to bring into much more account their own perspective, their own background, their own base beliefs as a means of filtering and organizing the information that comes into them. So I think it's a very, very different environment from, like I say, well, like when we went to school, where knowledge was what you were told as opposed to what you lived.
So, distinction between now end user that's now become a consumer. We've gone, you know, you're absolutely right. We've gone from a person editing, for 2 million people to read, to 1 million people editing. We've one percent to
right.
The we've essentially flipped the model that newspaper, other one, TV casts, and otherwise produced for us. We're in a way, you know, the masters of our own thinking, mm-hmm. rather than being the puppet that's on the end of someone else's activities. Are those two exclusive, though? The concept of, like, is Encyclopedia Britannica an exclusive entity or separate or at odds with Wikipedia? Or can those two somehow harmonize?
I mean, we live in a world where those two exist now. So, I mean, you know, empirically, the answer would seem to be yes, they can coexist. But can they both coexist according to the premises under which they've been founded? I mean, the Britannica purports to be authoritative. Authoritative means, in some sense, you know, more likely to be right than hearsay, shall we say. But in the world today, Encyclopedia Britannica is just one other information source. It has been demonstrated to be no more or less accurate than Wikipedia, and certainly as well, arguably, and I would argue that it's written from a very certain point of view, a very certain perspective, an educated British perspective, to be most precise, which means that it can be nothing but a partial reflection of the world. And, well, that's not what Encyclopedia was meant to be, and that's certainly not the grounds on which they base their price tag. You know, I mean, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica is supposed to be the final word on these things. So, you know, I mean, yeah, they can coexist, but can they coexist as they intend to exist? It's not clear. You know, can you have a dictator and a democracy in the same society? You know, I mean, it's that sort of question. And, you know, well, yeah, you can. I mean, Saddam Hussein is in Iraq, and Iraq is democratic. But, I mean, like, either Saddam is running the country or the democracy is running the country. You can't have both doing what they think they ought to be doing. So, you know, in Iraq today, you have Saddam in jail, and you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, in a sense, they can exist, but you're suggesting that one will take precedence over the other. You see the Britannica and Wikipedia as being of that particular nature.
Pretty much, yeah. I see them representing themselves as being authoritative in a world that no longer accepts the authoritative. Although, and I will hasten to add that we're in a transition period now. So, you know, parts of the world accept authority and other parts don't accept authority. And, you know, that's the cause of a lot of the conflicts that we find.
So what we're seeing right now, and this stems back to a couple conversations I've had recently. One was with David Snowden on how his exact statement was that the era that we're entering now, or that we've sort of got our foot partially in already, is of a significant magnitude as the Enlightenment Age. And I thought that was an interesting comparison to make, but certainly there seems to be something very unique going on in our world today, unique in terms of how we're learning and how we're communicating.
Sure.
Individuals come up overnight, and from a site that, like Dig, that wasn't known, really, mm-hmm. 18, 20 months ago, which is now a prominent site that's overtaken a lot of traditional, more authoritative sites. you've also seen tools like MySpace, end user creation tools, and regardless of the opinions and the current political hype around it in certain countries, these tools have made their way into popular culture at a pace that exceeds anything that we've ever seen come on before. In a matter of 4 years, a tool can become literally mainstream and integrated into the lives of hundreds of millions of people. So do you share that view that the current age we're entering in terms of our relationship to knowledge will significantly reorder our existence on magnitude with the Enlightenment era? Or is that too much of a prophecy to try and tackle?
No, actually, that's exactly what I think. And that's why I begin this sort of discussion by talking about qualitative and quantitative knowledge. Because the Enlightenment is characterized by the rise of quantitative knowledge. You look at the people who became important, and you look at the things that became important in the Enlightenment, and they all revolve around number and measurement. You know, look at the inventions, the thermometer and the Celsius and Fahrenheit thermometers. The telescope, Cartesian geometry. There's the whole list of these things. Copernicus. I wrote back in 98 or something, in an article called The Rise and Fall of Wired. I talked about Galileo, Copernicus, and Bruno, and these guys were the rogues and the hackers of their age. They were the people who had the new tools, right, and the new technology, right? And it's not that they knew mathematics. They were writing the book. You have people like Newton and Pascal and that, like, inventing the stuff as they went along. Before then, we had the syllogisms, we had the reasonings of the scholastics, and it was all based on qualities and sets of things with qualities, all SRP, all PRQ. Therefore, that was how we reasoned, that was how we thought. And the bringing in of numbers into this created an enlightenment, but it also created a scientific and technological revolution. It took a few hundred years to unfold, but it did, and we saw the change that it made to society. And I think that kind of change is happening now, and I think that kind of change is happening now precisely because our understanding of relations, our understanding of connections, seeing how things are connected, is allowing us to see the world in new ways and to understand the world in new ways, and it's in a way distinct from and beyond the mere mathematical way of knowing. And because it breaks down this ordered way of knowing that we used to have, it changes not only our conception of the world, it changes how we in the world organize ourselves. That's a very short form for a long statement, but before the Enlightenment, societies were defined by mass, right? The state, it is me, the divine right of kings, right? Then we get number, but we also get atomism, and we get democracy, right? And these are part and parcel with what comes with number, right? Number is the atomization of reality. Democracy is the atomization of society. What comes post-democracy is the same thing as what comes post-number, right? Where our organization of society, the way we govern ourselves, will no longer be by, counting all the individual blips that vote yes or no or whatever, but according to the structures that we form, the way we self-organize into different networks and how these networks interact. And it's a completely different understanding of self-government.
Okay. I'm going to leave that particular train of thought for just a bit.
Sorry about that.
One of the challenges I would see with that... I think one of the challenges I see with that is the sheer... the entire reorganization of society that has to occur in such a model. from every regard and every aspect. And sometimes change is, what's restrictive to change is not necessarily what it's needed, because certainly change is a continual process. What's restrictive is our unwillingness to let go of the things that anchor us into what we perceive to be reality.
Sure.
And when you suddenly, when you restructure, like you say, democracy, and we're seeing it happen on a small scale with tools like DIG is probably one of the more common ones, but you do have a different world. And even though in that case there is still a centralizing figure, just like within the open source movement, you know, with Linux, there is still one individual who has the say-so on what goes. Do you think it's possible to have a pure end-user defined space that has no centralizing or deciding elements sitting on one individual?
Oh, sure.
Or a group of?
But we've got lots of examples now. I mean, like, how do you think cities get built? You know, there's no city god. You know, there's no equivalent to Linus Torvalds in saying, yeah, this road gets built and this road doesn't get built. You know, you might say it's the Planning Commission, but the Planning Commission, as anyone who studied civic government knows, has only a limited say over how a city gets built. You know, and you know, the master plans are as often abandoned as they are followed. The most prominent activity for any city council is hearing variance requests. So, I mean, the city is built by the individual and autonomous actions of its inhabitants. Each house is built separately. Each road is built separately according to a separate need. Somebody decides whether or not to put a rose bush on their front lawn. They don't consult, right? So, I mean, we can understand this. But, you know, I mean, it's, you know, we look at the flock of geese, right? The flock of geese makes its way south. There is no head goose. Now, each goose flies autonomously. They make their own decision. And what they do is they try to fly where it's easiest to fly. And every once in a while, someone gets stuck being the leader. But, you know, but they're not really the leader. They're just the ones that are stuck in front doing the hardest flying. So we see this all the time, right? The presumption is that the natural state of affairs is to have a leader. But I think if you look at it empirically, you'll find that no, the natural state, if you want to say anything, is a natural state, and I'm not going to get into that argument, but the imposition of a leader tends to be an artificial circumstance, and that the power, very often that the power a leader obtains is through a manipulation of the environment in order to create an individual advantage rather than any natural way that people flow. So, you know, I mean, like, you know, you say that there has to be a Linus or whatever, but that's not necessarily the case. Look at RSS. You know, who leads, who controls RSS? Nobody controls RSS. Look at HTML on the web. Who runs the web? No one runs the web. You know, examples like that abound.
It sounds, a lot of what you're saying sounds a bit like what Stephen Johnson, I believe it was, that wrote the, what's his book?
Emergence, yeah.
A little bit about how ant colonies and cities, and they literally self-organize, which comes to an interesting point is, we've lived our lives and our society through what we call intentionality. I don't know how much it's actually been that, but we've liked to think, and we do this with our learning design, we do this with, well, really with anything in society, we still sort of have that holdover, but we plan in advance. And it seems that with a lot of what we're seeing with emergence is that the plans actually can only be seen in reverse. So what I mean by that is we used to think we take a course, we design it, we craft our learning outcomes, our objectives, and all these other wonderful things. We create our course content. Mm-hmm. We put learners through, and then they will emerge with a pattern that we desire them to have. Right. It seems, and this is really, we were not quite able to conceptualize it because we haven't spent enough time with this, at least in a learning sense. It seems what we almost need to do is just start with the interaction and start with the experience going through it, and then the patterns don't come as something we force in advance, but the patterns come after we've spent some time in the space and we look back, and then we can comment on what exactly happened. Much like your city example. You know, a city, isn't planned. A city is built by a bunch of individuals doing what they want to be doing, but all of a sudden you look back, there is still the creation of something, mm-hmm. even though it wasn't necessarily planned.
Oh,
is that in line with what you're saying?
Yeah, and sometimes there even is some intentionality. I mean, when Romulus and Remus founded Rome, they intended to found a city, and lo and behold, 100 years later, there was one. But, I mean, what they built in no way resembled what they had planned, and I think the same thing has to do with learning. Again, it's all perspective and point of view. Look at learning. I mean, learning, the course designer, if there is one, has a certain perspective on what sort of outcomes these materials will provide. An instructor will have a certain perspective. If I make this intervention of whatever, I say such and such, that it'll produce such and such an effect. The learner in a course has a particular reason for being in the course, and we need to acknowledge and understand that these perspectives are very often going to be different. Like the high school, for example, right? The learner's in course because, they'll be punished if they're not. I mean, that's a very different intention than the teacher who's trying to do some good for society, or the parent who also plays a role, who's just trying to get the kids out of the house for the day or whatever. We can run through. There's all kinds of motivations. And then even when the intention of being in a course is to learn something, what is learned, in fact learned, is often very different from what either teacher or student intended. I remember taking an introduction to modern philosophy class from a guy called John Bordeaux, and he intended to teach me about modern philosophy, Descartes and Hume and Kant, and I had intended to get a good grade so I could graduate and get a good job. And what happened is he ended up teaching me, and I ended up learning how to write clearly, because that's what the interaction between the two of us produced. It produced a lesson in writing and really very little to do with philosophy. Well, I guess he taught me some philosophy along the way, too. But, I mean, like, it certainly wasn't either of our intentions that would happen, but that's what happened. Now, how do you plan that? We have this assumption that we can plan these things ahead of time, and that there's some way of knowing what output these interventions is going to create. But, it's like predicting the weather, and I mean that not just metaphorically. It's the same kind of problem. It's one of these things where, very small changes can have very large effects or very large results.
Well, and that's one of the really unique challenges that we have today, is that, in a course that I'm facilitating right now, one learner just yesterday posted a comment and stated, what's the value of formal education or education at all? Mm-hmm. And he talked about an individual who had been an architect and had gone out and done some incredible things and was coming back speaking to the students. And then one of the teachers asked him, like, did you, or professors, what was the value of formal learning for you? And the individual ended up saying, well, I just sort of learned, and I did things on my own. Like one of the things, like building a tunnel, I never learned in my school at all.
Yeah.
I learned it on my own on the job.
Sure.
And the professor then said, well, actually, no, that's not true. You were in the course with us, and we taught you how to build a tunnel. And he said, oh, I didn't know. I forgot.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I guess part of the question then is, and my response to the individual was partly, at least, we, and I'm going to introduce a concept here that I'd like to chat about once we're done with my little story here, but it's the concept of a context game,
mm-hmm.
and it's a bit of an abuse on Wittgenstein's notion of language games, but I essentially said that let's say if you pick up a book, you take a book, and nobody ever remembers everything they read in a book.
Right.
We don't go back and say, oh, that book had wonderful grammar and beautiful spelling, and more than likely we remember a few key elements of the book. It might impact us in some regard. But when we reflect on it, that's what we remember. When we're in it, though, a book that has poor grammar and poor spelling and sloppy images, that'll influence. So we have different metrics of success in each space. So in formal education, we might not have that exact same metric as we have later on when we reflect and look back on the situation. So getting on to the concept then of context games. much of what I see, at least, in our ability to dialogue about knowledge has to do with defining what exactly it is that we mean. And you've brought out, you know, just the importance of perception.
Sure.
And perspective and viewpoints. So much of if you and I are dialoguing has to do with trying to create the context. And it almost seems that once we've defined the context, the discussion flows very smoothly. But once you have, to look at this situation, be it in, you know, any parts of the world where you have conflict, essentially what you have is two significant ideologies or context perceptions that are opposed to each other, and they can't seem to play a context game to form a unified perspective and or even to agree on what is appropriate in that context to dialogue about. Do you find that that's, or would you agree that playing a context game, for lack of a better word, is one of the key challenges in being able to communicate and share knowledge with each other? Or would that not even be an issue on your radar at all?
Well, I mean, the way you phrased that, my inclination is to agree with you. The challenge seems to be to, you know, and I'm called back to recollect some of the conversations we've had. The challenge seems to be to have people in a position where they're able to understand that there are different points of view and different things that are true, because truth varies according to context. A wide variety of things that vary according to context. I mean, I still, like, my favorites still revolve around education. And, you know, what constitutes an education, you know, what constitutes the answer to a why question is the set of alternatives that are envisioned or imagined to be possible. And if your alternatives are different from mine, explanations are going to be different. Why did the roses grow as opposed to what? Well, not growing, or not growing as much, or roses instead of tulips. You know, each one of these different set of alternative possibilities creates a different possibility for an explanation. Well, we put fertilizer, or there was sunlight, or we planted rose bushes instead of tulip bulbs. All of those constitute differing explanations. That's why, you know, when I talk with you about, you know, is there objective truth, I'm trying to push the case that there are some circumstances in which a statement that you currently hold to be true might reasonably and in good faith and rationally be held by someone else to be false. And you have to get past that point. If you can't get past that point, if you can't allow me to believe something is false when you believe that it's true, then we're going to run into these conflicts. And the only way to get past that is to somehow be able to allow that I live in a world that is structurally and fundamentally different from you. That, you know, and just like, you know, to all appearances, it's the same world, but my world is just built differently than yours. It's just had different things in it. And the classic example of that is the religious and the non-religious, right? For the religious world, for the religious person, their world has God in it. Period. End of story. Right? And they can't imagine, right? You know, they look at the atheist and they say, well, here's this person that lives in a world where, you know, the world includes God, but this person doesn't believe me. But the atheist, on the other hand, lives in a world where there is no God. And they look at these religious people and they say, well, here are all these people who believe in something that doesn't exist, right? And you have to allow, you have to countenance the possibility that those two objectively different worlds exist side by side in the same space, such that one person in the conversation lives in one of them, and the other person in the conversation lives in the other one. And then that is where you have to begin with your framework.
Then I'm going to sidestep getting into that discussion again just for now, but how would you, with that particular perspective, how does that move back to our discussion on Wikipedia and Encyclopedia Britannica, which do they both need to acknowledge that each other exists, or do you place different level of subjectivity or objectivity with an entity, not with perspectives of people.
Sure. In my world, Britannica is written by a person who lives in one of these worlds. It's written by a set of people who live in one of these worlds, right? There is one objective world, and they live in it. Wikipedia is written by people who live in many different worlds. And so consequently, Wikipedia is an expression of the interaction, or indeed even the intersection that happens between people who live in these different worlds. And consequently, the sort of truth that's produced by Wikipedia is very different from the sort of truth that is produced by Britannica. Britannica produces what is purported to be objective truth. This is what's true in the world. Okay? Wikipedia's truth is always contingent. All right? It's the product of the interaction of different perspectives. It's what they allow to be the case at this point in time. And you know, and what it is, and I find it very interesting, what it is, you know, what each will allow the other to say, more or less. I find Wikipedia, in a sense, to be similar to how you need to craft a set of laws in a society, where a set of laws is not, or ought not be, reflective of the fundamental values of some particular world view, but rather ought to be a set of principles that allows people who have different world views to live in roughly the same space without killing each other. And you see the difference, right? One's a very pragmatic thing, and the other is a statement of values. Go ahead.
Well, and I think exactly the point that you made, you know, what will each allow the other to say is, I think, at the heart of what, when I use the term a context game, I think that's the heart of what we're dealing with there, is when two people are opposed, what do they permit of each other, and how do they frame, and framework isn't really the right word because it implies too solid a boundary, but how do they frame the nature of the discussion as it goes forward? And that can, you know, how we framework our discussions often, you know, deselects a whole group of options if we've been too limited or too quick in setting that framework in place, because often we need to permit knowledge to speak for itself. And like I said earlier, we see it in reverse. We see what it meant looking back when we don't force our plans on it. So I'm going to step away slightly. I mean, there's so much that I would love to talk to you about that. Particular, I think my viewpoint, and we've chatted on this before, but is that there, on certain levels, not on all, but on certain levels, there is an objective truth that parties need to come to an agreement on. But again, that's not today's discussion. Let's look at knowledge then as a product and as a process. We've, I think, in the past seen it defined as a product. Britannica is probably a great example of it. It's something physical. You hold it. It's frozen in time. And yet we're seeing more and more that knowledge is becoming a process. And instead of the image that knowledge is a reservoir, we're starting to see that knowledge is a stream.
Sure.
When you put together your article on connective knowledge, you stated that you know, knowledge is a network phenomenon, and that to know something, and I'm quoting you here, is to be organized in a certain way to exhibit patterns of connectivity.
Right.
And then you extend it a little further and state that to learn is to acquire certain patterns.
Right.
How is that statement changed when we see in the past learning was acquiring a product? What does it mean to learn today then when knowledge is perceived, or at least in my eyes, perceived as a stream?
Well, I mean, that question presupposes that there was a coherent theory before. And, you know, I mean, part of the problem is I don't think that the theory they had before was coherent. You know? So, I mean, how has that changed when you view knowledge as a product? Well, you like my clock? I don't know if you can hear my clock in the background.
It's a great
it's
clock.
It's a nice clock. I like that clock.
I can faintly hear it.
I mean, look, people had this view. Some people still have this view. Like, you know, what we know is like a whole bunch of sentences that are written in the brain. You know, and when you try to flesh out that view, I mean, in my view, it's pretty ridiculous. But that's the view they have. And some people believe that this is literally the case, and other people believe it's metaphorically the case, and other people advance the nice, fantastic theory that, oh yeah, sentences in the brain are isomorphic to neural structures in the brain, and there's no way. But anyway, that was the theory, right? So learning was amassing a set of these sentences in the brain, and if you're an advanced learner, right, these sentences would form an internally consistent set, and then when you went to reason or think about something, you would run logical processes on the set of sentences. They're very much the way artificial intelligence worked, you know, production engines, things like that, where you'd have a whole bunch of condition action rules or if-then type rules, right? And then when you're presented with a stimulus, it would fire off a bunch of these rules, and lo and behold, because you've got these rules or these sentences in your head, you'd produce a reaction or an output. And so the idea of learning then was just to, you know, have people create these sentences in the brain. And this is always where I sort of tussle a bit with constructivism, is because constructivism seems to have still the sentences in the brain kind of theory, except people are constructing themselves. And, you know, and the sentences in the brain theory, when it becomes advanced and complicated, becomes something like Jerry Fodor's representations, where we're building not just sets of sentences in the brains, but sententially, syntactically, and semantically correct models or representations. So, you know, we're going to construct this worldview, and we're going to proceed very logically and add to it, and our terms are going to fall into certain taxonomies, and, you know, if something is dog, it's going to follow naturally that it's an animal, which makes it kind of strange when you say a play is a dog. But we'll leave that aside. That's too hard to understand. You know what I mean? And so, but that was the theory. And the problem is that theory was false. And the reason why it was false is because you can't nail down these sentences. There is, as the critics of logical positivism said, there is no such thing as an observation language. You can't even get your simple observation statements off the ground. This block is red. If you can't get that statement off the ground, you can't make the sentence theory work, and you can't get that sentence off the ground. What constitutes red? Well, what constitutes red, you know, we'll go back to Wittgenstein, you know, bring me the red slab, and the guy brings the blue slab, and that's not what I mean. I mean the red slab. Well, how about this one? He brings a mauve one or a purple one. Does that count? What constitutes red is, you know, a case of social agreement, personal acclimatization. What's red for you may be different than red for me, and I mean that not just the sensation of red, but we've got that whole, you know, the whole question of qualia, and do we actually perceive the same thing, etc. Do you see red the way I see red? You know, and we probably don't, otherwise you would like cheese and I would like cheese, and nobody would ever hate cheese, because, you know, I mean, cheese is the same for everyone, isn't it? So, but there are different tastes. But even, you know, as to what constitutes the correct meaning of the term, this block is red. What do you mean by this? Well, that varies depending on what you're pointing at. That now varies depending on your conventions of pointing. I was reading one of these travel books I read. I forget where it was. But people don't point using their fingers because they might actually point at someone, and that's considered rude. So they make head gestures in order to point. Well, pointing then from society to society varies according to convention, which means that a word like this actually fundamentally means something different from society to society. So red differs, this differs. I could go on and do block and is, but, you know, is requires 5 pages in the OED, you know.
And I think I can, you know, I can see the perspective that you're promoting, and I'm going to once again bring back the concept of a context gain, because mm-hmm. it's we in a pure language game, and you know, like Wittgenstein presented there with that example of, you know, bring me this block, and there's a social negotiation process. Mm-hmm. In a context, though, at some point, if you and I, every time if we wanted to say this red block, if we had to go through the process that you just illustrated, we essentially become paralyzed in our ability to communicate and dialogue with each other. So we do a lot of things that we draw assumptions on, and when we find that someone has misinterpreted what we've meant, and meaning itself certainly is a complex process as well, mm-hmm. then and only then do we re-engage in that kind of a context game where we try and re-communicate what we meant. But until then, there's a lot of assumptions, like we assume things. When we were in a different country, and I certainly found this, you know, being in Europe recently, we change that. We're heightened to the sense that things are different. But when I'm here, for example, and whether I point with my finger or nod with my head towards something, the act of identifying something may be different from country to country. But if we, in order to dialogue, we have to both be prepared to accept a degree of sloppiness in each other's dialogue, or else I'll never get a red block, period, right. Because we'll spend the time dialoguing about this and clarifying this. So we do, in order to move to the pragmatics or towards the functioning aspect of it, we have to start doing some sloppy, quick negotiations.
Sure. And I'm all over that. Sloppy, quick negotiations, I'm all over that. That's exactly what happens. But out of that does not come objective truth.
Yeah.
Out of that comes sloppy, well, pragmatic, it'll do for the next 10 minutes.
I'm trying, you know, you've brought this up, I think, 3 or 4 times now, and I'm trying so hard not to make this another objective-subjective discussion. I think it does attend to the core, you know, we both have a different view, and I think the one point I will acquiesce is that, yes, we do. There are areas where we do have subjective differentiations. I would say, however, and I know I'm not going to say anything because I've got a couple other questions. We're approaching an hour.
Yeah.
I
understand.
I'm willing to tackle this again.
But the reason why...
I just want to try and...
Sorry, George. The reason why I keep coming
back
to that is because that is the key point, right? That is the key distinction between the old approach to knowledge and the new approach to knowledge, is this whole idea of absolute, this whole idea of universal, this whole idea of objective. That's the key point.
Well, and I'll make one point here, and then I'm just going to happily move on to my next question.
Sure.
I'm willing to state, and I think I've always stated that, you know, there are things that are objective or subjective. There are many things, like you use the cheese. I mean, cheese in my eyes is an objective entity, but my experience of cheese is subjective based on you know, how you experience cheese. And we might both say, you know, boy, blue cheese is awesome, or one might say it's great, or another would say, you know, this really kind of sucks, actually. But there are certain things, especially when we get into these issues of life, of human dignity and democracy, and I guess the one thing I've never been able to shake past is that, you know, there are, in my eyes, a sense of dignity for all human beings. It's unquestionable in my eyes. I know it is in yours as well, because you write from a much more of an ideological perspective than I do, and you make it very explicit on your website as well. So I hold high regard for your pursuit of ideals and your acknowledgement of the, you know, the human spirit and the core functioning of being a human. So I'm not at all calling that into question. Mm-hmm. But there are individuals and there are societies that sometimes devalue the capacity of a certain member of society. And in my views, there's no subjectivity there. To me, it's purely objective. You don't. And you might say, well, but a society works that way sometimes. And yes, it might work that way, but it's not right. But anyway, I know that you've got a great answer to that, but I'm just not going to let you say it because I want to get on to a few other questions here.
Sure, okay.
And I'll try and limit it now. Like I said, we're getting on to about an hour, and I don't want this audio file to be insanely long. You brought up artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And artificial intelligence, I think, I'll make a presumptive statement here, but artificial intelligence has failed because it took a computer processing model view of the human mind. There are individuals who are, you know, attempting to sort of right that wrong within artificial intelligence, and they're taking more of a, and I would venture what you've said with connective knowledge is probably in line with what's being tackled by some, but what has to happen in order for our machines to do a better job of representing human cognition, or are we simply going to end up where artificial intelligence is really an augmentative process?
Well, I mean, part of the problem is there's two very different approaches to artificial intelligence. One, and you've touched on them both. One of them is a list processor based or rule based, or as I would put it, a symbol theory based approach, whereby the instructions, whereby a computer has instructions. These instructions are coded in a language, at root, basically, what makes a computer do what it does is that it's processing a list of instructions for the manipulation of data.
Right.
And that's the approach that's essentially failed. And I think it can be fairly safely said to be failed. The expert systems approach where, is it one of these or one of those? And you take your pick, and is it one of these or one of those? And it basically marches you through a tree or any of these sorts of things. They require that the world be ordered in a nice, neat way. They do not deal well with ambiguity. They do not deal well with vagueness. They do not deal at all with pattern recognition. The simple thing recognizing a number. When we recognize a number, we do it instantaneously. But if you think of a number, being presented to you on an image as constituting a set of pixels, it's going to have to run through 5, 6, 7 different types of iterations of a rule before you recognize that something is a number. And it just doesn't seem like we run through a bunch of rules in order to recognize things. We can pick out a face in a crowd, snap, like that, and it just doesn't seem like a rule-based system can do that. The other approach to artificial intelligence is connectionism or neural networks, and this is a way that I believe shows more promise. The big problem with connectionism, and people will tell you, is that it does not adapt well to symbol systems. It does not adapt well to abstraction, universals, things like that. And my view is that this is because symbols, abstractions, things like that, far from being the primitives of cognition, are very high level entities that result from cognition. They're the sorts of things that once you have massive huge connectionist systems, I have to struggle not to say connectivist. It's what happens when we have too many words that are similar. When you have a connectionist system with a billion neurons plus a 20-year training cycle, then you'll get some of the loose, sloppy generalizations that are formed by 20-year-old humans. The problem with connectionism is and always has been training, because neural nets require training, and the training is not always predictable. It's kind of interesting how the use of artificial intelligence leads us to connectionism, which leads us back to the problem of training. We have the same problem with our computers as we have with our kids. But that's an interesting thought. That is the route that we are going to take. We are going to have to take because, again, this is why this topic inquiry is so important, because it requires that you flip-flop, what you count as a low-level cognitive process and what you count as a high-level process. Pattern recognition, identification of relevant similarities, projections based on inferences from past cases. These, I think, are very low-level, and these happen automatically. These are habitual. These are the sorts of things that a connectionist system does very well and very quickly, and there are different types of connectionist systems we can talk about. And I think that given enough iterations of this sort of thing over time, we get generalizations like all dogs are animals. But I mean, coming up with the concept of an animal and putting a name to it, that's something that there's the whole process of stuff that needs to happen in a connectionist system before that's going to happen. And I don't think we've built the systems that we need, and I don't think we're able yet to build them. I think we will be able to build them. And I think, you know, when we look at the internet as a whole, we're sort of beginning to approach the scale of network that we need in order to produce some of these results, but only beginning to.
Well, and I think the challenge, I think, for artificial intelligence isn't duplicating the human mind when it works the way it's supposed to. And by that, I mean the general assumptions that we draw on pattern recognition and that. I think the challenge with any system is knowing when the human mind breaks rules. And rules is perhaps the wrong word, but, you know, when we're at a certain point, the inefficiencies that we bring in, how it is that we manage to still communicate when we sometimes use slightly different terms, when we have just huge, dramatically different background skills. It's how can we get into a context and forget those other parts of ourselves? You know, how can we sometimes dialogue with people who really piss us off? You know, excuse my terminology, but who really, you know, why can we still do that? How can we forget the other parts of our experience and still engage in a dialogue with them that ends up being civil? That's, I think, one of the key challenges. It's not what the human mind does that's rational. It's what the human mind does, the points of departure from rationality that still present us as an integrated, cohesive whole. That's, I think, one of the unique challenges with artificial intelligence.
Sure. Just connectionism go ahead.
No problem. I was going to say, one final question for you is, you've talked about connective knowledge, and you lay out sort of the four elements of connective knowledge. And okay, sorry, am I coming back, or is this losing connection here? Okay, I'm going to try again just to see if we're. Can you hear me now?
All right, that's better.
I feel like I'm in a TV commercial here.
Yeah.
Okay. With your knowing networks, you sort of bring out that there's sort of four criteria that are required, you know, diversity, autonomy, interactivity, and openness. Mm-hmm. With what you've talked about with connective knowledge, what kinds of skills do we as learners need in order to continue functioning in this new and improved knowledge space or knowledge stream or whatever that's required? And this will be my final question, but what do we need to be able to do as human beings to participate effectively in this new reality?
Oh, you want that in one sentence?
I'll give you two.
Well, I mean, the answer is always going to be something like, well, it depends on what we want to do. I mean, what I need to do is very different from what Wayne Gretzky needs to do, right? And I think maybe first that's what we need to realize, that, you know, we need to understand that each one of us is in a different circumstance, has different skills, different interests, different ambitions. And so the answer to a question like that is going to be different for each one of us. And we need to take our personal starting point as that starting point. I mean, I think, you know, and I think there's this social expectation, that, not to mention a personal expectation, that individuals would begin from some sort of common framework, and, you know, like, and everybody must do such and such, or, you know, and I don't see that as being necessarily the case. What that means is that, I mean, one of the things that I would say is that a person needs to be able to evaluate and weigh and consider the different options that are presented before them, the different candidates of sentences that purport to be the truth, the different world views, the different models of what constitutes a good life and a good society. All of these things, they need to see themselves as autonomous entities in this world and make their own choices, which means they have to have the capacity to weigh the input coming in and then make choices that are the best for themselves. What that means, well, then we could go into, you know, evaluating, the whole realm of critical thinking and decision making, and there's a whole slew of stuff that can follow from that. You know, I mean, you know, we come back to the four things. I mean, you know, that's the autonomy one. And then there's the diversity one. And, you know, these days, you know, certainly in this country, they talk about tolerance and understanding. But even when we were brought up, you know, it's like, you know, imagine what you, how you would feel, or walk a mile in someone else's shoes, or all of that sort of thing. And
right.
People need to actually genuinely embrace that, develop that sort of sense of empathy, that at the very least attempts to understand what a life is like for another person who may be very different and have a very different point of view. In other words, to accept and embrace diversity. But that also, you know, I think they also need to cultivate diversity in their own lives and in their own experiences, to try different things, to have new experiences. You know, and again, we could go off on what that means. You know, it means, you know, engineers should learn poetry, maybe. I don't know. Maybe I've just caused a scandal in MIT, but I doubt it somehow, right? You know, I think people would say, yeah, there's a poetry in engineering, and there is certainly an engineering in poetry. Otherwise, you could do anything you wanted.
Yeah.
You know, the openness is the whole, and interaction is the whole, communication and sharing. You know, there's, and, you know, to me, the thing that I've always felt was the thing that really gave me the advantage that I've had in my life was the capacity to communicate, you know, from writing and public speaking when I was a kid to learning how to write when I was in university, much more so than any subject that I learned. So, you know, it's these sorts of, these basic skills of how to become, you know, an individual operating in a network rather than as, you know, rather than as an atom in a society. That's badly expressed, but what I mean is how to be an autonomous part of a diverse society rather than being the same as everyone else. Still badly expressed, but you know what I mean there? It used to be the case, you know, you had to learn how to be Polish or whatever, but now it's something different.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the big things that I've seen is that we've been taught, at least, to see the world, and this may still be part of the original Britannic Encyclopedia or Wikipedia discussion, but we've been taught to see pictures and, you know, namely, this is a Polish person, and this is a, you know, this is someone who lives in Winnipeg, and,
yeah,
and this is someone who lives wherever, or this is whatever race, culture.
Sure.
We are taught pictures of people, and I think what we really need to do is start seeing continuums of life, continuums of existence, because we all possess elements of each other, and essentially by that I mean, you may be, you know, you may have attributes that are more heightened in certain regards, but a lot of those attributes, the certain type of thinking, approach, or views, another individual will have those, but just in different degrees. So it's seeing that continuum of humanity that says, you know, we are parts of each other, and we possess parts of each other. And to, you know, have a lot of disdain for the diversity of others often is to kill that aspect of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway,
the short form,
I think,
short form might be to be to see people not according to what they are, but according to what they do.
Right. Absolutely. Or another thing I've said in the past is we spend our time evaluating our own thinking, the beliefs that we hold based on what they include,
mm-hmm.
and we end up evaluating others based on what their beliefs exclude.
Sure.
Which is an interesting way, like two different metrics of thought, and in the end, it's, of course, it's going to gear us toward conflict and antagonism, but that's, I guess, part of being a human, so we have work to do, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, Stephen, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat here, and I certainly value the insight and certainly what you presented in your original article on connective knowledge. So thanks very much for your time, and I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks, and to those listening on the podcast, hi, pod people. Hope you're having a nice day.
All right. Okay, thanks, Stephen.
Talk to you later, George.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Even.